Accession number 10165, reel number 48.
Martin McLean, reel 48. What sort of treatment did you receive on the hospital train then?
When we arrived on the hospital train, it was amazing. It was an Indian-run hospital train, and the doctor in charge of us was a little chubby doctor, and he couldn't do enough for us, and unfortunately he just knew a smattering of English. The first things we received when we got on this train was little gifts from the Red Cross, toothbrushes, a little holder, soap, and odds and ends of that description that we'd require for general hygiene. And then the doctor went round the train, eventually sorting everybody out and treating them. We weren't very long on this train. We had no idea where we were going. Apparently in Dimapur there was a vast build-up of military area, you know, for the Americans and for supplies to Burma. It had been intention, apparently, to use it as a jumping-off spot for invasion into India. And so all these depots and places had been built in prior advancement of anything that was going on that way. And the train was running along this line, and every now and again he would stop for maybe 2 hours, and then you see people being unloaded off the train and carried off to hospitals. What happened, we found out, was that the doctor had to just drop off people where hospitals that were in the region had space and facilities to deal with these lads. We were more or less walking wounded, and we eventually landed up about a day and a half later on at a place called Panatola. Panatola. I don't know how they spell it. It was the end of the rail line. It was the end. And they took us off the train and put us in ambulances and took us to this small hospital in Panatola. And we were sitting on cement pathways. We're told just wait there. And we were a bit browned off and dejected, you know, at the way everything had gone. I was more or less dejected at my state of mind and also at the loss of so many great pals. And I was sitting on this pathway a bit dejected. Now, the pathway is raised about a foot above the ground level, allowing for monsoon waters and, you know, flooding the area for the hospital staff to walk around. And a beautiful woman's voice came along. Cheer up, Sir Major, what's wrong? And it was a British nurse. I'd never seen or spoken to a white woman for such a long time. And she said, what's wrong? I said, well, it's just the way the lads have been treated, nurse. And she says, oh, don't worry, we'll have it fixed shortly. The same nurse came to speak to me and asked me what I was talking about, the way we'd been treated. They thought we're getting VIP treatment. Now, we had to sit on this veranda thing, or pathways, and then the doctors and the nurses were all rushing around, getting into whites, obviously, to do some treatment of us. And a Dr. Sumner, he was an English doctor, he came along and he started sorting out the worst cases, you know, and he says, right, we'll treat you in that order. And then they told us that this was an Indian hospital. The whole hospital was Indians' illnesses and sicknesses and things like that.
Was it a civilian hospital?
No, it was a military hospital. Captain Sumner was he wasn't the officer in charge, but he was the surgeon. And there was white nurses also, which we hadn't seen. Only in Calabar Hospital when I had malaria. And he told us that in this hospital, they had to clear a complete ward of Indians out to make room for the number of Englishmen that were coming in. They didn't want to mix the coloured people with the white people. And we were a different kettle of fish. We were people who had been fighting. Yeah, there were illnesses and sicknesses, not so much from actual gunshot wound or injury through war. It was just normal sicknesses, malaria. So we waited some time. They cleaned out and washed out this ward that we were in, and then they let us in. And one at a time, we went to see the doctor, and they start picking out the phosphorus out my hands and legs, and dressed me, and we all got into this bed. And we're in you've got to imagine a nice clean hospital with its beds all laid out, and nice sheets and blankets and everything, and white nurses, which is, I say, all strange to us now, because we are getting very much jungle men. We're absolutely cut off from white women or talking to white women, and we used to treat these nurses very strangely, you know, more or less adoring them, more or less, you could say. We got settled into this hospital, And there wasn't a wireless, nor any method of making music. The people are just lying there mourning if they were in that sort of pain, or talking with one another quietly. We always spoke quietly after being in the jungle. We never shouted nor be raucous, because that was a system you got into when you, even when you'd done your jungle training, you kept your voice down so as not to raise it, so as not to let the enemy hear you in the area. And you spoke only when you had to speak. And this was the conditions that we were in there. We'd just come out of battle, still shocked. And the men were speaking very lowly and quietly in order to make conversation. But when one goes into these hospitals, you would expect there to be some music, some entertainment, something of this nature for the lad and the troops, but nothing at all, absolutely nothing. So we just used to wander from bed to bed, talking to the lads. I did anyway, talking to the different lads, asking what was wrong with them. We had one lad there, a Sergeant Hetherington. He had a very bad wound in his biceps, upper bicep of one of his arms, and it was giving him a great deal of trouble, and it was also giving Dr. Sumner a great deal of trouble. And so they had this man flew out to a hospital in India, and he eventually lost his arm. I didn't know this till the man died, a lifetime later on, and that was only, this is now 1988, so it would be about 1970-79 when I got to know that he died and had lost an arm. I met one of his relatives, and he was telling me about it. That's how I got to know. Otherwise, I'd have been in contact with the man. In this hospital, were receiving good treatment, but the men were getting a bit browned off for laying around, so the doctor suggested that I take the lads out for a walk. They're walking wounded. You know, he said, you can walk out. There's nothing here at all. And he explained the layout. He says, further up the road there, there's two big aerodromes, Dig Boy and Big Boy, American aerodromes. And there they supply equipment and warlike stores over the hump, they call it, the high mountains, into China. The Burma Road being cut off, they couldn't now supply the Chinese who were in bad need of this equipment, so they were flying it over the hump by the Dakotas from Dig Boy and Big Boy. And he says, you may, if you land up there, you might even go and see a film show there. They have some good films. So we dressed up in our blue, a royal blue trousers, a royal blue jacket with a white shirt with the very thin blue stripes in it, and also a red tie. Well, we took the ties off because it was too warm. It was Burma. And we took our coats off and we were walking along the road in bandages and slings and different things of this nature, trying to find the Dig Boy and Big Boy aerodrome. And I must say, somewhere along the line, we lost out. Really speaking, we shouldn't have done, because the roads, there's only two roads. One converges left, one converges right. And it sure is fate. If Martin doesn't have a map, he'd take the wrong one. So I took the left-hand one. Walked along this road, and we saw an American soldier sitting on the side of a road with his legs cross, one leg cross the other, and his rifle across his leg. And I was always interested in these Garand rifles that they had. And I went up and spoke to him. He suddenly jumped up, you know, startled, because we didn't look like British soldiers. We looked like escapees from Belsen, with all the greatest respect. You know, bandaged and these blue hospital outfits on. No means of identification, no pay books, just as we come out the hospital ward. And this lad cautiously asked who we were, what we're doing, why we were making inquiries about the aerodrome. And when I told him that we'd been wounded at the Battle of Kohima, he was all agog then. I didn't realise the Americans were so interested in this battle, because later on I learned that if Dimapur fell, which was just behind Kohima, then the whole of the American forces that was fighting both to try and make the Lido Road through to join on the Burma Road, and all the aircraft and all their supply bases that were supplying stores across the hump, would have to withdraw out of India altogether. It was as crucial as that. I'll tell you a little bit more about that later, how I got to know how so important it was. And the lad was, by the side of this lad was a beautiful cement road curving away into the jungle. And he said, well, he says, you're quite a distance away from the airports now. He says, why not go in here? This is remarkable. You have to, it's so funny. They can scarcely believe it. When you tell people, they scarcely believe it. He says, we've got a road show on here tonight. He says, just go along. He says, go in. He says, you'll be welcome. After we'd had chat, and he showed his Garand rifle and how it worked, a big, heavy weapon. And off we went, walked up this pathway, and we came to this beautiful, well-made American camp with its long bamboo bashes and made much better than ours, with beautiful cement roads, whereas we never made roads. We're just tracks, you know, earth. And we found a shelter with a roof on and seats. It obviously was an auditorium of some description. And we went and sat in there. We were apparently the first ones there, so we sat a while. Actually, looking a bit foolish, we thought we were being taken on by this lad that was a roadshow, and you couldn't expect it. Nowhere. Then American troops start coming in, and they're looking at us, and, you know, in such amazement on their face. And they were wanting to talk to us, and they were frightened to talk to us, but there they are, they keep glancing. When they got together, they were chin-wagging about us and pointing to us. And then eventually one of them disappeared, and then come a top sergeant, I'll call him top sergeant, three up and three down, big burly man. And he says, who are you guys? And I told him what we were, and oh, he nearly fell over. And he says, right, you sit there. And then a short while afterwards, in came an officer. I don't know what rank the officer was, but he had the insignias of officers up. And he wanted to know all about it, and I told him that we'd been fighting a battle at Kohima, and that we'd been wounded up there, and we'd been sent down to this hospital at Panatola. I said, if you ring up Captain Sumner, or ring up the hospital, ask for Captain Sumner, he'll tell you that he did authorise us to come out. You know, we had no identity at all. And we knew that everyone is super cautious about all fifth columnists and what have you. We didn't look like fifth columnists, we looked real British. And that was that. The show came on, and on came a dance band, the railway dance band, the Burma Assam railway dance band. It was amazing, a full modern band with all this equipment, jiving and whopping like the Americans do. And then on came 13 beautiful girls. It was hard to conceive that you'd find girls all in their evening dresses coming on the stage as they did. And the show to me was, it was hard to say it wasn't a show. The band was playing. And then each girl in turn took it in turn to come on the stage. And then the men would shout, where are you from, sister? I come from Idaho or Cincinnati. And they'd all get up and give it, those that come from that area, give it a big clap. And I'd ask her questions about the thing, about what was happening out there. And they'd stand there for about 5 minutes. And each one in turn came on like that. And the last one, true as I'm sitting here, was a girl from London. And we were amazed at that. We didn't speak to her because we didn't have that way of going on like the Yankees. But they really tore the place down when she said she was from London. They all gave her a big hand, including us. And that was that. I met her later on. So the show went on, and it all consisted of the band playing and these girls. One or two of them sang a song, and then disappeared. But this to us was something we wanted to change, an uplift. So this big officer came along, and the sergeant major, he says, come along, you guys, towards the end of the show, or the show has ended, we want you to come with us. He says, we're having a dance after this. He says, now you're our guests of honour. He says, never mind the ladies, you're our guests of honour. And we went in this huge long barrack room. And it was lit, electrically lit, by the way, which we always had oil lamps. And all along round the walls, they had coloured parachutes hanging, draped us along the side to give it take drabness off the drill hole, or off the hall. And down the centre of the hall, they had huge brand new tables laden with food, food such as we had never seen in years since leaving the Empress of Canada. That was the ship that took us overseas. In front of the tables, there's brand new dustbins full of steaming liquid coffee. You could have black coffee, white coffee, or whatever coffee you wanted. And they just gave us pots and stuff. They said, hey, I'll help yourselves. We got coffee. Couldn't get tea, by the way. And I'm a tea lover. And along we went, and they heaped on cakes for us, and they sat us at a table. We thought it was a wonderful reception. And everybody was coming talking to us then, in their funny way, you know. What's it like up there, you know? And we didn't want to talk about war. We were still shocked with it. We said it's grim, but we'll win. And I told them the 2nd Division was up there. Who's the 2nd Division? I said it's the all-white, regular British division. And they'll sort the Japs off from Kohima. I said there was a big battle going on when we left, and I'm quite sure they'll overrun the place. It cheered them up a little. And then I went to the stop sign. I said, well, we'll have to get away. I said, we've got to walk back to this hospital. He said, no, what? What? No, no walk. And I put a great big six-ton truck on, a six-wheeler truck, and I don't know what six-ton must have carried more. But these trucks used to hurl along these roads at such a terrific speed in these narrow Indian roads. So they put us on this truck, and the top sergeant and two or three of the lads who would start talking to and panning up with came along with us and saw us off to the hospital. And we went in there, we'd had a lovely night. We'd had a nice change of a time, and we were telling the boys about it. Next morning, the two jeeps came racing up to the camp in the same sort of flurry of a hurry that they have, the Americans. Never seem to go slow. And the world up in front of the building, you could hear the brakes screeching. And in come these Yankees, laden with candies and beer and a gramophone and records, and shouting along to the lads, how are you guys? And the sister the nursing sister told them not to make so much noise, but they couldn't quell the Yankees, you know, the way they went on. They just ignore our officialdom, the way that we go on. And they put on the gramophone, and they brought the sweets and the candies and the beer around the lads, and they sat on the beds talking to them. And the first gramophone record they played, I always remember, it was Judy Garland singing A Great Day for the Irish. Now, I've tried to get that record again and again, or tried to get requests played and can't get it, but it was definitely Judy Garland. She was my favourite. Judy Garland singing A Great Day for the Irish. And they had some marvellous records there, you know, Bing Crosby's singing records. And we were having a real whale of a time in this ward. Captain Sumner, the doctor, came along to see what was going on, and he was quite pleased that the troops are being so well looked after. The Yankees went away and left their gramophone and said, hey, you keep that. If we want it back, we'll get it. And off they went. Well, it turned out that these lads were Merrill's Marauders. Now, Merrill's Marauders is something like our commando. It was a man who formed a group of do-or-die sort of men to work with the in the same line as our commandos. And they had been pushed up to help Vinegar Joe Stillwell in making this road through to Lido, into Lido, because they had also with them not only soldiers, they had engineers, mechanics and bulldozer crews and all this. So they were being used for this job, and also used for fighting against the Japs up at Michenhau, they call the place. They're having a lot of trouble with them. There's two Chinese divisions up there, and also Americans, and they couldn't dislodge these people from there. And they were having a job. Anyway, that's how these men were. They were Merrill's Marauders. In other words, were fighting men. And they were delighted to meet other English fighting men. Well, as time went on, they kept bringing more stuff and more beer, more candies, tins of candy they gave us. And bringing more gramophone records. They never did take the gramophone records away. And then some of us started getting shifted to other hospitals, you know, we'd done our treatment there. But they thought that I was fit enough to rejoin my unit, so off I set, once again back by rail, fully equipped, with all my rubbishy stuff on. They made us up with the other equipment that I was lacking at, from the hospital.
What sort of state were your hands in? Had the burns healed up properly?
I was still in bandages, but they considered I was fit to go back to action. And I put brown bandages on so they wouldn't show up so much. The skin was practically all healed over, with the exception of one particular part was sore, and I just had to go for medical treatment. It was like a sore knee or a sore hand, as you have. And I set off and I landed back at Dimapur again.
And what time would that be? You'd been wounded around about St. George's Day?
About 5 weeks, I'd say, 5 or 6 weeks.
So into the end of May?
Yes. I don't know exact dates. You see, we who lived in the jungle just didn't worry about dates and months, only on the opening stages of the thing. I do know this, that when I landed at this Dimapur, the force's sweetheart, what they call her, Vera Lynn, was there giving a concert. And the story was that she couldn't give much of a concert. She'd contacted dysentery, but she was sitting on the tail end of a lorry that she was, they'd got the men around, and she was entertaining them. I didn't see her, but the lads were talking about it. So I landed up in this Dimapur. And in a very short while there, it was a staging camp, reinforcement camp, where you stay until so many men are collected of the same regiment and or the same division, and they push you back up. And then I took ill. I don't know what it was at the time, and I just had to go and see the doctor, and the doctor said, oh, he says, looks like you've got malaria. So they pushed us out the line altogether, and they sent it, and I took malaria, and then I took food poisoning, and then I went to Calcutta Hospital, and whilst in the hospital there, I took dengue fever, and then I was in the hospital, and they were curing us, and then all of a sudden, malaria would crop up again, and then dengue fever, and I only got it once, and then food poisoning. I was getting a repetition of them.
You'd had malaria and food poisoning before, but
yes,
this was worse.
Yes,
was
this
it?
Was worse.
What was dengue fever? I've not heard of that.
Dengue fever, it's worse than malaria. Every part of your body aches, and you go out, you can't remember much about it, but you wake up and you're in intense pain. And the nurses there, I remember when I woke up, they were sponging us down with cold water to keep us cooled off. Dengue fever, I know a little of, but there's quite a lot of troops had it, by the way, and it's one of the reasons why they wouldn't take me blood after the wars and malaria for blood transfusions. At Calcutta Hospital, they started querying me and questioning me. They found that I was debilitated, is that the word of it? Run down, badly run down. And then I passed from hospital to hospital going down the line. But I'd like to go back to Dimapur. When I was at Dimapur, I met some of the lads that had served with us. They were in the same line, coming from hospitals, or had been away for some reasons, and were talking about what had happened. And then it was only then that I learned with such sorrow of so many men of the battalion being killed. There was 151 men killed in the Battle of Kohima alone. The colonel had been killed. Nearly all the company commanders had been knocked out. Young Lieutenant Wilson, who I mentioned, was left behind and caught us up on the train. Actually, he was a captain. I'm quite sure he was a captain. I said lieutenant, but I always knew him as lieutenant. And he got killed. My company commander had been killed. And the second commander of the battalion had been killed. The signal officer had been killed. The CO had been killed in a carrier. A shell had hit it, and that was that. But there was 15 senior officers of the battalion went. And learning all what was happening with the battalion, it was rather upsetting. Pals you knew, names were coming out of people who were killed. But that is a soldier's life, but you still want to know what has gone on with your battalion. Leaving that, on another strange thing at Dimapur, I went out walking with one of our lads called Sergeant Ward, and we walked around a corner, and we saw like a man's penis in full erection on the ground and made in mud, and on the bottom of it was like little vases and little joss sticks in them and bunches of flowers. And we walked through this area, and then we come across things like women's things. And we couldn't understand what this was all about. We knew, obviously, what the huge erection was. And then somewhere along the line, they'd start a book in the second division called Cross Keys. And the lads, I never did say this because I never did get any copies, you know, being going out. But some of the men, like Bob Bulmer of Barney Castle, he has a full set of the books because he was, or the newspapers. He was, I said, a CQMS, who was with me in France as a sergeant. And I had a secure job, and I could put these papers away and keep them, you know. And there's a photograph taken of these places at Dimapur. And it said it was something to do with their religion. If an Assam man was barren, his wife was barren of a son, his wife would erect this phalanx of a man's erection and burn flowers and these joss sticks at the foot of it. And a similar thing with a man. He'd have this clitoris effort made of a woman, and he'd burn joss sticks. And they were quite large, 8 foot high and 9 foot high, and there was quite a lot of them in the area. And that's no story, but there's a photograph in that in Cross Keys, the second-div magazine, the second-div newspaper, which Bob Bulmer had a copy, and he was always going to let me have a look at it, but we never did meet up in Barney Castle. Well, I thought I'd just mention that in passing, because it was a strange thing. Another thing, regarding on the same token, we had, just when we were down in Belgaume, we had an officer had been wounded in the front, and he was doing some recuperative training, and they sent to teach us jungle law just before we moved off to go to Kohima. And he had his black, or his Gurkha servant with him, Batman. And he used to give us lectures. And one of his lectures, he was explaining to us, he took the kukri out and showed us this. He says, a lot of people call this, the kukri, a vicious weapon. He says, a good weapon. He says, and he started telling us how the Gurkhas use it for not cutting the head off an oxen. And if you can cut the head off an oxen in one blow, you're a champion man. And he says this, the ridge that runs down the front part of it, or the back of it, is to let the blood drip down. He says, nothing gory like that. He says, that's to let the air into a wound if, you penetrate, stick it in it to somebody. And he says, there's a little cleft near the handle. He says, that is actually represents a woman's clitoris. It's part of the old Buddhism religion. He says, and people call that sight, because if you look, it's just like a foresight sticking up, surrounded. And it looks like the foresight of a rifle. He says, people say it's a throw knife. He says, you couldn't throw a kukri. He says, but that is what that is. So we'll leave that and just mention it in passing.
So you went back to hospital in Calcutta?
I went in Calcutta. And then from there on, I started going down to other hospitals because I was losing so much weight. I think they were getting worried about us. I was down to about 8 stone now. And I was looking like a skeleton. And it was at these hospitals that the doctor started interviewing me and questioning me about my state of mind, I think. But I was physically fit, I thought. But I was constantly getting this malaria and food poison. And yet, being in hospital, I should have not been getting the food poison, but I was. They couldn't understand it. It was just happening to me. It was something in me inside that I'd eaten, or maybe my stomach so disrupted through the Arakan, the food that had been eaten there. And I must say this, they were having a lot of trouble with troops with bad stomachs at this stage. For instance, a lot of them had the sprue worm. A sprue worm is something you take in either food or through your feet. I don't exactly know how I know one can go through your feet, another can go through food. And the whole of the inside turns to little worms. I mean literally worms. And they found that they tried all sorts of treatments to cure these people, something like the tapeworm of the old days, but they couldn't get rid of them. The only way they could possibly get rid of tapes, one of my great friends, by the way, had it. He landed back in England, was all right afterwards. Robert Twaits, or Tommy Twaits, I forget his first name. They send them back to England when they've got that. And the cold weather cures itself. There was another sort of worm that used to come in through the feet and used to do much the same thing. And it was a very bad one, this one, used to kill the men. So troubles of this nature, something getting in your inside and causing upsets, was quite a common thing in India or Burma. Maybe malnutrition, maybe the food we're eating, or tin food, one never knows, or people being allergic to different foods. But there was all the stomach trouble going on, not to mention dysentery. So they start questioning me, doctors, and ask me about my actions, about my war, and telling them. And then they said, well, we think you've done enough. And I the way doctors talk, one was talking to the other. I think this man's done enough. And then I landed in a hospital a big British military hospital. The same Raja, the boss of the place, he sent England a lot of bomber aircraft and fighter aircraft, Spitfires, paid for Spitfire squadrons, paid for Spitfire bombers. And And how he got this money, he taxed all of his people on his estate. Now, all the Indians, this is unknown to me, they have coconut trees grown in the area, and they breed them, and they take the sap off them, and they make a very strong liquor with it. And they have a white stuff called gin, and they also have another stuff that they mix with water and it turns white. And it's a strong drink. I tried it later on when I was out wounded, after I'd been wounded in a convalescent depot. Cannot remember the name of that place. Anyway, I was in this hospital, a big